Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. Today, wow, what a guest we have lined up. Don't miss this show. We're talking to John Stanley today, K4ERO. All I can say is this man has written the book on shortwave radio. He's written the book on DRM broadcasting, graduate of MIT. I guess rightfully, we should refer to him as Dr. John Stanley, although he corrected me on that and said, just call me John. Anyway, this is a special show. Let me tell you, him and his wife, Ruth, are some of the most fantastic people I have ever met in my life. Foremost radio engineers, absolutely. And on top of that, just incredible people. So let's get this going. Our guest, John Stanley, K4ERO. Our guest today is John Stanley. His call sign is K4ERO. And John's wife's name is Ruth, and she also has a call sign, WB4LUA. And she may be joining us here at the beginning of the show, but she's got some things to do, so it's going to be just John and I here for a little while talking about things. You know, John Stanley, let me just say this. My knowledge of what he has done and what he's accomplished probably scratches the surface on everything he has done and accomplished. I know that John and Ruth both have worked for HCJB in Quito, Ecuador. They've worked for Trans World Radio. And I can honestly say I've been told by those that know that he has literally written the book on DRM. So with that in mind, I'm going to say hello to John. And John, you're just going to have to fill us in because, let me add this. This fella and his wife are probably the two foremost experts on international shortwave broadcast transmitters. And they reside in Chattanooga. And anyways, now, John, you go ahead and you can fill me in a little bit as to some of the things that you and Ruth have done.
Actually, after that introduction, I can hardly wait to hear myself what I might be going to say or have done. You're very kind and generous. And but we have had a very fascinating career. We've worked with virtually all of the major religious broadcasters. We've consulted with some of the secular broadcasters. We've been involved in many, many different radio facilities around the world. We've been in 62 countries. We've retired recently, or almost retired, after about 45 years of working in international broadcasting. So it's been a very exciting life.
I guess I could go back to the beginning of this thing, wherever the beginning is, and maybe you can tell me, what was your introduction into radio, period, or how did you get on this path?
Well, I got my ham license in 1954 when I was 14 years old, and have really been fascinated by radio ever since. So I took my university training at MIT in electrical engineering. After that, also went on to study some theology because I knew I wanted to work with Christian radio stations, and they usually require a little bit of Bible training of some kind. But we ended up at HCJB. Of course, along the way, I met Ruth. Actually, I met her in a ham radio class. We were both attending a school that we were taking a year's course in what we would call cross-cultural studies. That is, you know, how to relate to people in other cultures and other countries. And as part of that, I was teaching a novice class, and she was one of my students. So I told her at some point that if she would get her novice license, I'd get the marriage license, and it went from there.
Now that's cool. I'll tell you what. So then she got her novice license, and you two got acquainted. And how long was it before, after the novice classes took place, and I assume she got her ticket, how long was it between then and between the time that you guys were actually married?
Not very long. We were at this training center, and let's see. I think probably within about a few months of the time that I met her, we decided that we would get married, and within about another 3 or 4 months, we were. So that would have been in December of 68. And within a few months, we were in India, working at a junior college, junior technical college there, teaching electronics. And she was teaching English, and I was teaching electronics. And we were there for 3 years before going on to Ecuador, HCJB.
You know, I will make this comment. Watching John and Ruth work together, it's like watching a right and a left hand at the same time. In other words, it's you know, like John is the right hand, she's the left hand, and then, you know, when they get on something else, she's the right hand, he's the left hand, but both hands working together. You guys have developed this, I don't know what you want to call it. You know, it's like the, matter of fact, I'll tell you, when they're working on things together, I don't even think they need to communicate in terms of speech. I think they just know what each other's thinking, and they just do what they're going to do. But it's really amazing to watch these two, a husband and wife engineering team, you know, work on one of these giant transmitters. I mean, I've never seen anybody work like this before. I've never seen that much of a, I guess I want to say a close communication, and being able to work together and the synergy between the two of you. Now, I'm going to ask a question. Now, I probably shouldn't ask, but do you ever, did the two of you ever not get along?
I don't think we have ever had what other people would call a fight or even an argument in 47 years. We've always been very close together, physically and in every way, emotionally and spiritually. She anticipates what I need all the time. I can tell you a funny story about that. When we were working in Palau, out in the Pacific, installing a shortwave transmitter out there for a radio station operated by a High Adventure. I was approached by one of the other people out there working. Well, no, actually, Ruth was approached, and they said to Ruth, "Is it true that John is blind?" And she said, "No. Why do you ask that?" And they said, "Well, we've been watching you, and it seems like every time he needs a tool or something, you're right there to hand it to him." And in fact, sometimes I would say, "Ruth, I need the drill," and and it would be sitting literally within hand's reach of me, but I would ask her for it. She would hand it to me. And they'd also notice that she drove, and I was the passenger when we were traveling. I do drive, but most of the time when we're together, she drives, but just because she prefers it. So they put two and two together and concluded that I must be a very visually impaired, and that, in fact, the story that was going around was that I could tell what was wrong with a broadcast transmitter simply by listening, and then I would explain it to Ruth, and she would fix it. that wasn't quite true, but we're always within arm's reach of each other, I guess, and we've loved it being that way all of our lives.
Well, now, you know, I guess the question I'll have now is tell me a little bit about your Christian experience. Now, you know, of course, you know, I know you guys met at a CW, or a, I'm sorry, CW, a novice code class that you were teaching. And I always equate novice with CW, so I guess that's because I did so much CW as a novice. Tell me a little bit about your spiritual background. How did you ever become a Christian? And on top of that, how did you, I guess I'm going to say, come in contact with your own calling as to what you felt you needed to do?
Well, I was raised in a Methodist church in East Tennessee, and I am a lifelong Methodist. In fact, I was, before I met Ruth, just before I met Ruth, I was ordained as a Methodist pastor and served churches for 2 years to pay off the seminary training that I had received at their expense. But I really got serious about the Lord when I was at MIT. And some people might not think that's a very Christian school. Most people wouldn't associate it as a Bible school. But in fact, the years that I was there, and I think it's still true today, there was a Christian community there that were very serious. And there were a lot of young folks. In fact, just this last week, I was with one of my former MIT classmates who is a very keen Christian. And so I was challenged to get more serious. I had been kind of nominal in my faith, and I was challenged by that to get more serious about it. And I decided that, yeah, it was something I wanted to commit my life to. So while I was at MIT, actually, I contacted HCJB and asked them about coming and working with them in an engineering capacity. And they told me that that all of the engineers that worked with them needed at least a minimum of 1 year of Bible college. And I thought I would go to a graduate seminary instead of an undergraduate Bible college. So I did that, and I got so caught up in that I actually finished 4 years of theological training. And then, as I say, I went on to pastor churches for a couple of years to pay off the debt that I owed for them having paid for that training. And so then I got serious again about going to the mission field, which I had kind of felt all along because of my contacts with HCJB that's what I wanted to do. So I ended up at this this missionary, they call it Missionary Orientation Center, but what it really is a place that trains people in cross-cultural, a preparation for cross-cultural ministry. And there I met Ruth. She grew up in the Reformed Church in America in Michigan, and no one in her family had ever been involved or dated anyone who was not Dutch and Dutch Reformed or Reformed Church in America. So it was a little bit of a shock for her family when they found out she was going to marry a Methodist. So we caused families on both sides to stretch a little bit in their appreciation of how big God's family is. But we got married and went on to India, served there for 3 years, and then on to Ecuador. But it's been an adventure, and I've never regretted.
You were talking about India. I was going to say, what was it exactly that was in India?
Well, we were teaching at a Methodist college, a junior college in India. A technical junior college. It was called at the time Lodipur Technical Institute. I was there to expand their programming or their educational program to include television, which was just in its absolute infancy in India at that time. There was one TV station in New Delhi, and that was all. I also was introducing a course in medical electronics because there's so much medical equipment that's been donated to the hospitals in India that no one knows how to maintain or fix. And I was also going to teach a course in sound studio, radio production. So I was involved in that part of radio as well. We did that, and Ruth worked in publicity and also taught English. My brand of Tennessee English was not something that the average Indian student could understand very well. So she tried to help them get in tune with my English so that we could be effective teachers.
Okay, now, being in India and teaching there, how then did you transition to, I think you said you went from there to HCJB?
Yeah, well, our my long-term goals had always been to go to HCJB. That work in India was partly, again, an obligation for paying off or paying back the United Methodist Church for having paid for my 4 years of education at the at seminary. But we were quite excited about the work that was going on over there, and training Christian young men who were of lower caste, many of them, to be able to do technical work, because the There's no radio, there's no TV repairman cast in India. And so even though you might be from a lower caste, if you would learn a technical skill like that, you could escape from some of that situation. But we had always been interested in HCJB, and I had maintained contact with them, continued to be in contact with them. And actually, we got kicked out of India in a certain sense, because you may recall that there was a little war between India and Pakistan that led to the creation of Bangladesh. And when that happened, the United States at that time was a quite close ally of Pakistan. India was more closely tied to the Soviet Union. So after that war, Americans became sort of persona non grata in India, and we were not able to renew our visa. So that raised the question again of where shall we go next? And so we again raised the question with HCJB, and at that point, they were very receptive in having us come to Ecuador and work with them.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. When you went to go to work for HCJB, this is an international shortwave radio station that's doing some very unusual things. For example, like reaching into Russia in the Russian language. What was HCJB's outreach in terms of, I guess as we talk about shortwave stations, I guess you'd have to say target zones and languages and such as that.
Well, when we got to HCJB in 63, I think it was, they had seven transmitters, of which six were on shortwave. A couple of them were relatively low power, like 25 kilowatts for, reaching South America and other parts. But then they had three 100 kilowatt transmitters, which were mainly used in overseas service. Most people in the States who had listened to HCJB probably listened on either one of the 50 kilowatt or maybe the 100 kilowatt transmitters. But we were beaming at that time a lot of programming to Europe, including Russian and German and several other. The Swedish language programming was always very popular because there are a lot of really keen Swedish shortwave listeners. So we had a pretty major amount of outreach to Europe, and when conditions and propagation were perfect, that 100 kilowatts did a good job, but there were times when it was difficult to get through, which eventually led to the construction of our 500 kilowatt transmitter, and some really big antennas. Some of our antennas, one of the antennas that most hams would be familiar with, if I describe it, it was an array of quads. It was six elements on each boom and four booms, two above and two below. So it was a total of 24 element quad that was tuned to 21 megahertz. There's a 21 megahertz shortwave band as well as a ham band, of course, and that was beaming to Europe.
I remember people talking about that quad antenna, and did you have anything to do with the construction of that?
Well, that particular antenna was already there, but I did build some other quads.
You're listening to QSO, and our special guest today, John Stanley, K4ERO. We'll be right back right after this. Here at QSO, we hear success story after success story. We hear excited people telling us they just got their ticket using Ham Test Online. That's right. This is the easiest, most concise, as well as fastest method to get that ticket in your hand. Ham Test Online. No thick books to read, no DVDs, no CDs to wade through, no studying for hours and hours and then forgetting what you studied, and no irrelevant information that you have to wade through in order to get to the things that are really on the test. Ham Test Online. Now, if you've already upgraded to Extra Class and you no longer need the services of Ham Test Online, we want you to think about this. Ham it forward. That's right. Ham it forward. Now, what is that? There's a lot of folks out there that would like to Elmer someone into the hobby, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Don't know if you could really tackle the project. There's folks out there that would like to teach a class of maybe three or four people or maybe larger. But you see that as a real undertaking. Don't know if you can quite handle that. Working with someone and getting them their ham ticket is one of the most satisfying things that you could do as a radio amateur and promote this hobby, moving it forward with new blood. That's why we have Ham It Forward. Now, this is a cooperative effort from Amateur Radio Roundtable, the QSO Radio Show, and the folks at Ham Test Online. All you have to do is get a subscription for a new prospective ham, and then just follow through with them a little bit and let Ham Test Online take them through the steps and get their ticket painlessly, easy, and fun. Keep this in mind. It's a new program. We're calling it Ham It Forward. We'd love for you to participate in this. Everybody knows someone that they would love to get into the hobby. Give a gift. Give the gift of the ham radio, amateur radio hobby by Ham It Forward. Go to hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Or look on the QSOradioshow.com website. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes, and yet so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind? I'm talking about the Skywave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the Skywave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a Skywave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a Skywave mentioning WTWW, you will get the portable, retractable wire antenna absolutely free for mentioning WTWW. So go to their website, seacrane.com. Hey, for all of you folks out there that have an interest in the Bible, you've always maybe wanted to study the Bible. You enjoy listening to Bible teaching, but you don't necessarily like the preachers that you see on television. Hey, listen, tune in to 9475. That's 9475 when you get a chance. And listen to the Scriptures for America radio network. You might find that you're going to hear some really accurate, very pointed, however, Bible teaching and Bible study, something that you may really enjoy. The other thing is Wednesday nights. If you have a need in your life, there's something going on, you need somebody to pray for you, it's a Wednesday night prayer meeting on the radio on 9475. And those folks would just love for you to join them. Just remember that. Give it a listen right here on WTWW. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And now back to our guest, John Stanley, K4ERO.
By the way, while we're talking about quads, I want to give a plug. There's a special event station that's going to be operating from August the 21st to the 29th. every day from 1430 to 2200 Zulu for a week, for that week. And this is going to be operating from what used to be called the HCJB Engineering Center in Elkhart, Indiana. It's now called Sunset Solutions. And the call sign of that will be N9Q for quad. And the purpose of this is to celebrate the 73rd anniversary of the invention of the quad antenna in Quito, Ecuador, by Clarence Moore, HC1JB. And the frequencies and all are available both in the latest or the August issue of QST under special event stations, but it's also available at a website which I can give. It's Sunset Solutions, S-O-N-S-E-T, Solutions, all one word, .org, /N9Q. And if folks will go there, they'll have all the details about the frequencies. They're going to be operating on four bands from 40 through 15 meters. It will be, I think, all sideband operation, no CW.
The cubicle quad, and you have to excuse us, folks, we're not exactly operating a complete duplex system here. So in order for me to say anything, I kind of almost have to interrupt him. And it sounds a little rude, but we're trying to work with this. The cubicle quad, though, this is what it was that hit my mind that I had forgotten about. Was he not he was the inventor of the quad, was he not?
Yes, there's some discussion about what it was he actually invented. It was not exactly like the quad that we know today. But Clarence Moore invented an antenna for shortwave broadcasting. The one that he used was a two-loop, not a two-element, but a two-loop. In other words, a single element, a single loop, you might say, but with two turns on it. The reason for that being is that allowed him to feed it with a 300-ohm open wire line instead of coax. In his patent application, which came along about 7 or 8 years later, he illustrated the two-element quad with the reflector. But it was a little different from what we know of as the quad today, but certainly in the direct ancestry of it. And Clarence was very, very much a promoter of the quad. He, of course, HC1JB, he was a ham, operated a lot on 10 meters and got a lot of people very excited about the quad. And so he definitely was, you know, he made a very, very big contribution. And then later on in his career, after he left Ecuador, he sold quads and again promoted them a great deal. And in fact, on the top of his factory in Elkhart, Indiana, which is Crown Incorporated that made tape recorders for the broadcast industry, he had a 24-element quad there that was identical to the one that we had in Ecuador that was an array of six-element quads, four, two high, two wide, and he used that on the 15-meter ham band. We used ours on the 15-meter, actually it's called 13-meter, but it's the same frequency, 21, right above the 15-meter ham band. We used that for broadcasting.
That's incredible. Let me ask you a question. With the sunspot cycle the way it is today, is that a good international shortwave broadcast band today? I mean, I know propagation changes, and I back when that quad was being used, I'm wondering what propagation was like then.
Yeah, that was a very good band back during the peak of the last sunspot cycle. In fact, HCJB also broadcast quite a bit on the 11 meter shortwave band, which is 26 megahertz. So we used not only 21 but 26 megahertz and got a lot of coverage of Europe and Japan and all over the place. By the way, we used a quad for that also. It was a six-element conventional quad, single boom. But the 13-meter band, 21450 to 21750 roughly, that was a band that was very, very effective to Europe from Ecuador for many, many years. And in fact, we did a lot of DRM on that. We did a lot of single sideband on that. We did all kinds of experimental stuff for shortwave listeners on the our frequency that we liked was 21455, which was, of course, just 5 kilohertz above the edge of the ham band. So hopefully a few hams that were careless when they were tuning and got to the top end of the band without realizing it, they would tune onto our frequency and hopefully not transmit, because that would have been out of their band, but they could have heard our broadcasts in single sideband or DRM.
You say 11 meters, that's actually the 11 meters is also Citizens Band, which is, I think, though, there were 27 megahertz, isn't that?
Yeah, that, well, some of the channels are 26 something, and some are 27 something. So it's kind of straddles the 27 megahertz frequency, but the 11 meter broadcast band straddles the 26 megahertz frequency. So they're both 11 meters, but they're 26 versus 27 megahertz. So it's a little bit below the CB band in frequency.
Well, now you were talking about a 500 kilowatt transmitter at HCJB. And of course I really wasn't aware what they were using when I was a kid. I just listened to them, you know, and, I guess my question is, of course they billed themselves as the voice of the Andes, when they did station identification and all that sort of thing. Tell us a little bit about this 500,000 watt transmitter. Now, were you involved in the construction of that thing at all?
I was indirectly. I specified a lot of it because at the time that was built, I was the, I guess you'd call me the chief engineer. We had other titles and, of course, Spanish titles and so forth for down there. But I would be probably considered to have been the chief engineer for HCJB at that point at our transmitting site. And so in that capacity, I helped to specify what we wanted out of that 500 kilowatt transmitter. But we sent a group up to Elkhart, Indiana. And that's where Clarence Moore, who invented the quad, was very helpful. He provided a free building for HCJB missionaries to go to and use, plus their plant facilities, to build this 500 kilowatt transmitter. And among the things that I asked for very specifically, I can recall, was that we didn't want one light to come on the front of the transmitter that says that one of the doors is not closed properly. We wanted a lot of lights, and they would come on and tell us which door was not closed properly, because I had been going crazy many times with that light that says a door is not closed properly, and then you'd go around beating on all the doors trying to figure out which one. So we included some features like that were helpful, but the transmitter was built primarily to help us get a stronger signal into Europe during times when propagation was not so good. Most people that listened in the States would not have listened to that 500 kilowatt transmitter, because it was mainly carrying languages like Russian and German and languages that they would not have been familiar with necessarily. Certainly some people would have heard it, but most of the people like yourself that grew up listening to HCJB on 15115 or those frequencies, that was either one of our 100 kilowatt transmitters or maybe even one of the 50s.
Let me ask you this question. You were involved in the construction. Were you in, obviously you must have been involved in the implementation of this transmitter.
Well, when the transmitter came down, yes, I was partly involved in the installation of it, and then some of the early testing and so forth. We had also built some other transmitters down there. Well, actually, up until that time, most of the transmitters at HCJB had been built by our own people. The only transmitters we had that were not built by our own engineers were some RCA 100 kilowatt transmitters. We had three of those. But by the time I left HCJB full-time, I was still continued to be involved with them, but I left them full-time in about the late 70s. By that time, we had 11 transmitters, and of those, I think only those three RCAs were commercial transmitters, and everything else we built ourselves. And we had, I take it back. We had one Harris transmitter, which you're familiar with, the famous SW100, which had been donated to us by Harris. But that one Harris and the three RCAs were the commercial transmitters, and all of the others were built by our own engineering staff, including that 500 kilowatt. Since then, we only built one of the 500s, because about that time, most radio stations decided that was kind of overkill. Shortwave became a little bit less popular about that time, so the interference cleared up a little bit. And so from then on, HCJB built additional 100 kilowatt transmitters, of which they've built, I think, 8 or 10 now at this point.
Well, I was going to say, because I remember hearing stories about the fact that, you know, that HCJB builds their own transmitters, you know. And also, I don't know if they're still involved in this or not, but were they also not engaged in doing building the DRM exciters and the DRM paraphernalia that goes with broadcasting DRM?
Right. HCJB has been very involved with DRM since the beginning. We operated some DRM from Ecuador for quite a while. HCJB also at the engineering center there in Elkhart, which is what is now called Sunset Solutions, by the way, but same facility, same bunch of people. They were very much involved in designing some affordable DRM exciters. The DRM exciters that were available at that time, which was about 15 years ago, were like $80,000, and they were just out of reach for an awful lot of people. And so HCJB was involved in designing some DRM exciters that would be much more affordable. And we were involved, by the way, with Harris Electronics in Quincy, Illinois at that time. And we collaborated with them on doing some DRM exciters for AM stations as well as for shortwave broadcasting, although they got out of shortwave about that time. But yeah, HCJB has been very involved with DRM equipment from the get-go, and not only building the equipment but testing and building equipment. And so we're very much committed to the future of shortwave being digital.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask about that because I guess I was going to ask you, what do you see? I mean, it was obviously you've done more than work for HCJB. Now, I know we haven't even got to the other parts yet. but I guess my question is, based on everything that you know and all you've observed, when it comes to shortwave and digital, let me say this. I hear about, you know, countries that are eliminating their shortwave broadcasting, and I hear the tales of woe saying that shortwave radio is on its way out and all that kind of stuff. Okay. But you'd never know it from our broadcasts. QSO radio show, the amount of mail we get in, if you want to call it a mailbag thing, is astounding. And I'm doing two music shows on WTWW, Saturday and Sunday nights. And the emails, 600 emails sometimes before an hour is elapsed when I first come on, and then it just continues to the point where you really can't even check the email. So, I mean, I know a Chicago FM station couldn't do this. We're told that in the days of Willis Conover, when he was on Voice of America, I don't know who, I got this somewhere. I believe it's accurate because I remember reading it. They said that his audience for the jazz show was about 30 million is what the BBC had estimated. And back during that time, of course, John, you know, shortwave radios had tubes in them. In the days of Willis Conover, there were no small, tiny, transistorized Grundigs that are made in China. They just didn't exist. It was all tubes. They all sat on top of the table. And today, for every one of those tube sets that used to be around, there's probably 100 of these small handheld radios. So I look at it like this. I think shortwave is in its heyday right now. This is probably the biggest population on the planet, the most radios that's ever been in the existence of shortwave, and they're out there convenient so that you can listen in your backyard, you can take the thing with you if you're on vacation, if you're at the beach, or wherever you're at, you know. You can pretty well near listen, and especially if you're listening to a good, solid, powerful station that's running, you know, 100 kilowatts or 250 kilowatts on a decent antenna system, you're going to pick that thing up indoors on a whip, providing you're not 2 feet from a computer, you know. And so anyways, now with that said, that's my opinion. You may differ from my opinion, but what do you see as the future of digital on shortwave?
Well, let me say a little bit about the future of shortwave in general. You can go back into the 60s and find people predicting that that shortwave had another 20 years to run. And then in the 70s, it was another 20 years to run. In the 80s, it was another 20 years to run. And, you know, it's kind of like the people who said that TV was going to kill off radio in general. And more people listen to radio today, just, you know, than ever before, in spite of all the other media. Right now, I see a shortwave in sort of two areas. One of them is there are still a huge, huge, huge number of people listening to shortwave in Asia and in Africa, simply because you can buy a shortwave radio for $10. You can not get any other means of access to the outside world for a price even approaching that. Now, that's all on analog at present. Now, the digital that we've had so far up to now, and probably right now people listening to digital shortwave, 90% of them are listening on their computer using Dream software or something like that. And so that's a completely different audience. Now, as far as how that those two things are going to come together, to me, the most interesting thing that's happening right now is in India. And of course, I have some interest in that, having spent 3 years of my life there, training people in communications and technical things. India has really committed big time to going to digital shortwave, and they're going to use the digital, they're going to use the DRM system, both shortwave and medium wave, I should say. What has held up DRM for 15 or 20 years? At one point, I was predicting that it, by 2003, that most shortwave would be digital. I would be hesitant to say now that that would be true even by 2023. So it's been much slower than what we had thought, mainly because the receiver manufacturers have not made major commitments. But now India has said, we're going digital, and they've got the transmitters, and the receivers seem to be on their way. So I think the day will come pretty quickly when there will be major numbers of people listening to inexpensive DRM-enabled receivers, and that's when things are going to really make a flip in Asia and Africa. Right now, it's all analog, but there are still huge numbers of people listening.
I guess from your perspective, how do you think that DRM fares up? If you're listening on a small receiver, how, I mean, we already know we have selective fading and whatnot on on conventional shortwave, and you know, so and a lot of people are really intrigued by that. Matter of fact, a good portion of our listeners will write in and say, "I just love listening to the music on shortwave. You know, it has a certain warmth to it because of the." I don't know, the different phase relationships that are taking place, you know, as the signal is doing whatever it does up there in the ionosphere. But technically, I mean, do you have long periods of dropouts with DRM? Does DRM hold in there? I mean, how does it fare up to analog broadcasting?
Well, I'm with you on the listening to the old system. I'm a great AM band listener. I love to listen at night to the various stations that come in, and yeah, okay, you've got fading, you've got some interference, you've got times when it drops out, you can't hear it at all. But to me, that's got a nostalgia appeal or something. It's something amazing about it. But I can understand how people that are raised on digital media all their lives, might not be their cup of tea. The listening that I have done on DRM, and I haven't listened as much in the last year or two, actually since Sackville went off the air, I've listened quite a bit less, but I have been amazed how reliable and solid it is. When I used to listen to Sackville, I would listen for 3 and 4 hours at a time, as long as their transmission, you know, lasted, with virtually no dropouts. And when there were dropouts, it would just go silent, which to me is much less noticeable. If you're not really sitting there paying it real close attention to it, you don't even notice those dropouts. So the improved quality is the improved reliability is tremendous. the quality can be fantastic. I know that some of the broadcasts in stereo, DRM stereo that I've listened to from HCJB, and again, this was back obviously before they closed down the shortwave in Ecuador, but some of that was such high quality. It was just absolutely amazing. And I think it may not be quite as dramatic as the shift to digital television, but it's close to it. I don't know what your opinion is about digital television, but I watch off over the air antenna, you know, antenna based TV here, and the television reception that we get here in Georgia where we live over the air is just so incredibly better than what we have with analog, I just constantly remind myself how bad it used to be. And when we go to motels and stay occasionally that have a cable system that's still analog, even on a cable, it's just dramatic, the difference. And I think the quality is just about that good, and the reliability is excellent. And I really think that the move to digital in India is going to be transformational, and people will look back on the old technology the way we look back on analog TV today.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering, why do you think it is that DRM has not been developed over amateur radio?
I don't know, because it's certainly been available for quite a while. I think part of it might be that amateur radio has a certain nostalgia appeal to it. It's kind of like me listening to the AM broadcast band. Single sideband has a certain appeal, you know. It sounds funny to people that aren't used to it, but those of us who've been listening to it for 50 years, we like that sound. and digital, it's almost a sterile sound, isn't it? I mean, if you want digital quality, you talk to someone on your cell phone. Well, here's the other thing is, you know, what is it about ham radio that appeals to people in this modern day, when you can call anywhere in the world on a cell phone for, you know, very little cost? Why would you put thousands and thousands of dollars into ham radio equipment in order to talk to the same people very unreliably or relative to a cell phone? What is it about the appeal of ham radio? I think that sometimes by making the quality too sterile sounding, shall we say, I'm not sure what word to use, but you actually make it less appealing.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. I do a lot because we're doing broadcasting. I have tons and tons and tons of vinyl records, you know, and I make a big deal out of, you know, recording them on the hard drive only because of the fact that I put two turntables in the studio and I said, you know what, I'm going to use these turntables on the air, you know. Well, I forgot. You know, first off, I'm not using 45 RPM records, which are the easiest to do on turntables in a studio. But I was using 33 RPM albums that have jackets and sleeves. And, you know, you start playing 2.5 minute cuts on two turntables while you're on the air and dealing with the album jackets and sleeves, you're busier than a one-armed paper hanger. I mean, it's amazing, you know, because now you got to find the cut on the album and you got to cue it up and everything. And I thought, boy, oh boy, oh boy, have these computers just spoiled the daylights out of me. I couldn't deal with doing the show with two turntables and a whole bunch of LPs. It was nerve wracking. So I've made a, you know, a thing of, okay, we're just going to record everything onto hard drive. And shoot, that's in a database. You go in there, you put the first name of the artist in, bam, there's the song. You know, you can find it, drop it into the automation system. It's just, you know, but I got heavily involved in trying to denoise these things, taking the clicks and pops and all that kind of stuff up. And you can do that. I mean, you can make it noiseless, you know, from off the vinyl. But I don't know. I sat down and put a record on my system, and I'm listening to pops and crackles and all this kind of stuff, and I found it comfortable. I thought, you know, this, all of a sudden it was like I started relaxing because I was hearing something familiar, you know. It's almost like music on a coming across a loudspeaker where there is absolutely no pops, no crackles, no hiss, nothing. It's almost too stark. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, yeah. The question I ask, Ted, is why do people ride horses? Surely we've got much more modern, better, more efficient, even less expensive. You know, keeping a horse is very expensive. So why would someone ride a horse when you've got, well, even, you know.
Well, my first answer was going to be because they don't have to pass emissions.
Yeah. So, but, you know, there's just something comforting about some of these older technologies that, and I think that's kind of where we're stuck now is, you know, in ham radio with single sideband. You know, it works. We like it. We're comfortable with it. Yeah, digital would, you know, digital. Now, here's another question that's relative. And when you're talking about a text mode, why do people still use the old RTTY? You know, that is nowhere near as efficient and as either power efficient or able to get through under noise as PSK. And yet, you know, there's still contests, there's still RTTY contests and so forth. So some of these legacy modes, I guess we could call them, still have a great appeal to people. And I don't think we'll ever get everybody listening to digital shortwave. I wouldn't want to do that even if we could.
Yeah,
but for people who listen for content, and that's all they listen for, it's not a hobby. They're just strictly listening to hear the news or to hear a program or something that'll change their life. I think digital is going to be a big leap forward.
You're listening to QSO. And our special guest today, John Stanley, K4ERO. We'll be right back right after this. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you will get the portable, retractable wire antenna absolutely free for mentioning WTWW. So go to their website, seacrane.com. Here at QSO, we hear success story after success story. We hear excited people telling us they just got their ticket using Ham Test Online. That's right. This is the easiest, most concise, as well as fastest method to get that ticket in your hand. Ham Test Online. No thick books to read, no DVDs, no CDs to wade through, no studying for hours and hours and then forgetting what you studied, and no irrelevant information that you have to wade through in order to get to the things that are really on the test. Ham Test Online. Now, if you've already upgraded to Extra Class and you no longer need the services of Ham Test Online, we want you to think about this. Ham it forward. That's right. Ham it forward. Now, what is that? There's a lot of folks out there that would like to Elmer someone into the hobby, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Don't know if you could really tackle the project. there's folks out there that would like to teach a class of maybe three or four people or maybe larger. But you see that as a real undertaking. Don't know if you can quite handle that. Working with someone and getting them their ham ticket is one of the most satisfying things that you could do as a radio amateur and promote this hobby, moving it forward with new blood. That's why we have Ham It Forward. Now, this is a cooperative effort from Amateur Radio Roundtable, the QSO radio show, and the folks at Ham Test Online. All you have to do is get a subscription for a new prospective ham, and then just follow through with them a little bit and let Ham Test Online take them through the steps and get their ticket painlessly, easy, and fun. Keep this in mind. It's a new program. We're calling it Ham It Forward. And we'd love for you to participate in this. Everybody knows someone that they would love to get into the hobby. Give a gift. Give the gift of the ham radio, amateur radio hobby by Ham It Forward. Go to hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Or look on the QSOradioshow.com website. Hey, for all of you folks out there that have an interest in the Bible, you've always maybe wanted to study the Bible, you enjoy listening to Bible teaching, but you don't necessarily like the preachers that you see on television. Hey, listen, tune in to 9475. That's 9475 when you get a chance. And listen to the Scriptures for America radio network. You might find that you're going to hear some really accurate, very pointed, however, Bible teaching and Bible study, something that you may really enjoy. The other thing is Wednesday nights. If you have a need in your life, there's something going on, you need somebody to pray for you, it's Wednesday night prayer meeting on the radio on 9475. And those folks would just love for you to join them. Just remember that. Give it a listen right here on WTWW. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website. Simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And now back to our guest, John Stanley, K4ERO.
Word for them.
I was going to say, I'd give anything right now if I had my old Model 15 teletype machine and the old tube type TU that I built when I was a kid, just to be able to fire it up and get a signal off the air and let my two sons and grandson and whoever else here see the thing operate. I mean, it's like it's a show. I mean, you get that old thing going chunk 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 chunk, you know, we used to send pictures back and forth. I remember there were pictures of the presidents and pictures. Oh my goodness, at Christmas time, all kind of Christmas tree, and it's all. There's no color involved, obviously. It was just black and white, but I used to have all these pictures hanging on the wall, and I had the rolls that went to the perforator or re-perforator or whatever they called them back then. I had a Kleinschmidt, too, I remember. But, yeah, it'd be kind of cool. It'd be really cool to have that set up. And can you imagine being able to show that to a group of young people who are prospective hams, you know, wanting to get into the hobby? I think, I can totally buy into that. I can see that completely.
By the way, when did you first get your ham license?
Oh, well, I got a ticket and then it expired. Okay, let it go. And I was quite young when I got the first one. You know, I don't remember exactly when it was. I think I was probably somewhere to the tune of around, 12, 13, something like that. You know, it seems like that was about when I got the first license. Then I let it go. And then I did something you weren't supposed to do. I went and went after the novice again, which I understand once you had the novice and let it go, you weren't supposed to go back and get another novice license, but that's what I did. And it was a lot later. And that's when I wound up with a call sign WB8PUM. And, but my first novice license, I really, really enjoyed. I mean, as a kid, I didn't really care if there was a microphone attached to the rig or not. I was having so much fun collecting QSL cards, and I don't care if they were from across the street. I just wanted another one to put up on the wall. But anyhow, that's, I guess, the only way I know how to answer that question. I was going back to the DRM thing. There is some digital modes that they were using on HF. I remember them selling like an encoder, decoder, or something. Had you ever come in contact with that at all?
Yeah. Of course, some of the VHF rigs have their digital modes, but there were HF modes also that were digital. There is actually a DRM mode that works on ham radio, and I have not used it on the air, but I have played around with it. And the way I've done that is to simply record, make a transmission, record the transmission. Probably it was not on a tape recorder. It was more recent than that. It was on a digital recorder, and then play it back and play back the WAV file and see if I could copy it. And I've played around like that some, but I've never actually done it on the air. And I guess one of the reasons for that is it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. You got to have someone you want to talk to and who's also equipped to do that. And there were some people, and maybe still are some people, that were using those modes. But, it's got to reach a certain critical mass before any kind of a mode can catch on, because unless there are two people who just talk to each other, which, is possible. Most of my HF operating nowadays is like that. I just talk to a few people and, the same ones over and over, friends that I've known for years. But for general operating, unless you reach that critical mass where you can go to a certain frequency and expect to find someone on there that's using that mode, then there's no way for the thing to get going.
Well, I'll tell you something, not switching gears, but we were talking about nostalgia, and I don't know if we were talking about nostalgia, but old modes or whatever. There's a popular, the growing popularity of running AM. It's a big thing now. Old AM transmitters for broadcast stations are coveted by hams who want to get them and put them on 80 and 160 and I guess probably some 40, I don't know. But I tune in and I listen. Now, to me, AM sometimes, to me it's a little aggravating because of the noise. There's a guy in there talking and he hasn't got much of a signal and the noise is just driving everybody crazy. Where on sideband, he'd be totally, completely legible. But when you get a good, strong signal and those guys are in there talking, the quality of those AM guys is just incredible. They're so easy on the ears listening a lot. You don't really realize how bad sideband sounds until you listen to a QSO in really good clean AM. And who would think that folks would be fostering AM on the air? But I'm hearing guys that are building up their own
homebrew PDM transmitters and stuff. And what I have learned listening to the AM crowd is these guys technically are far more savvy than their counterparts running slot bucket. I don't know if you've observed that, but it is funny. I mean, I don't have a lot of patience for listening to AM, but I would prefer listening to sideband only just because I don't like to strain. But boy, when you get in there, when there's a bunch of those fellows talking that have really good signals, it's irresistible as far as listening is concerned. Have you listened to any of this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's no doubt that those guys, many of them are very technically astute. I've thought about building a PDM a modulator for AM. In fact, yesterday I was tuning up a transmitter that you probably will identify with. I was tuning up a ARC 5 command set transmitter on 40 meters yesterday, and I am going to modulate it. A friend of mine gave me about a dozen ARC 5s, both receivers, transmitters, and I'm in the process of checking them all out and selling them on eBay for him. So I had one of those, and I got it going. And maybe later or on Monday, I'll apply some modulation, make sure it will modulate. Probably won't get on the air with it, but those are a lot of fun to mess around with. But the old vintage ham gear too. A lot of that is well maintained, and boy, some of those transmitters sell for big money on eBay these days because they're in good shape and well maintained. The broadcast transmitters are great, too. I've converted a number of broadcast transmitters to shortwave, by the way, but for broadcast purpose, not ham. 10-kilowatt AM transmitter, and you put it on the 6 megahertz band or one of those, makes a really great broadcast transmitter for a small station that wants to reach out, a few hundred miles. So that's a lot of fun to do that conversion. And but I enjoy listening to the AM guys. A lot of them are very knowledgeable, and they're usually very considerate. They operate at times when the band is not real crowded, and which of course they need to do because they're taking up about three times more bandwidth than the typical sideband station. But that's an aspect of the hobby that I could get involved in if I was looking for new worlds to conquer, shall we say.
Well, we've kind of we've gone down a different road. So let's talk about you're at HCJB. We were talking about this 500 kilowatt transmitter, and I was just going to ask you about anomalies. I mean, if you've been working with a 100 kW transmitter, now you're responsible for a half a million watts. What kind of strangeness, what differences are there? What are the things that immediately get your attention, that you have to change or do?
Well, it's pretty much the same circuitry. You got to do a few things differently. The main thing that draws your attention rather quickly is that there are limits to how much voltage you can put on a transmission line, for example, or even between two points in the transmitter. I would say the voltages are more exciting in a 500 kilowatt than anything else, and you can get some very, very interesting corona discharges and things of that nature. Now, this was especially a problem for us at HCJB, and it relates to why we built most of our transmitters, by the way. The transmitting site at HCJB was at 8,600 feet, which made it the highest altitude, high-powered shortwave transmitter site in the world, and very few commercial transmitters at that time. Now, FM transmitters is a different matter. A lot of them are on mountaintops, but shortwave transmitters are usually not at high altitude, and most of the commercial ones you buy were not designed for nor tested to work at that kind of altitude. And so we were forced in the transmitters that we did buy, like the RCAs, we were forced to do so many modifications to handle high voltage that it was easier just to start from scratch. And that was certainly true with the 500 kilowatt transmitter. I mean, you could get arcs between transmission lines. We used all open wire lines, 300 ohm lines, four wire balance lines. And the voltages across those lines are many tens of thousands of volts. And if you get an arc established across one of those kind of lines, Of course, the transmitter detects that up to a point and shuts off, but some of those were very, very exciting and great balls of fire, I guess is the way to describe it.
I was going to say, because I recall some time ago being at a shortwave station and coming in, and the fellow that was working didn't quite understand everything, and the window was open, and the antenna was down on a river bottom, and he said, "Well, you know, I think somebody put a speaker down there in the middle of the antenna field." He said, "Down there by the river, they put a speaker down there." And I said, "A speaker? Why would they put a speaker down there?" And listening through the window, I could hear, you know, some preacher's voice just echoing up from that river bottom. And I thought, we need to have a close look at this. So I went outside back behind the building and started looking down toward the river bottom. And sure as a world, there was a big arc, you know, on the line down there. And there's no telling how long it had been there. I mean, I guess it, you know, it looked like it was just arcing out into the air. And it wasn't really, it wasn't like going across two wires or, you know, the two lines. It was just coming right off the antenna wire and just arcing into space. And, but boy, it was loud. I mean, it was an electrostatic speaker is what it was. Had you ever seen anything like that?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And the ones that can continue are the minor ones like that, that are going off into the air. Now, if it strikes between the two wires, usually that's so heavy that it kicks the transmitter off the air, but it may take a few seconds. I can tell you a funny story about, time when we were living at the transmitter site, fairly close to the antennas, closer than we would be allowed to live today because of radiation hazards standards. But we were living in a house that had formerly been a medical clinic, but had been converted into a house. And so this guy came to our door, and he was walking very slowly and obviously in a lot of pain, and one of his legs apparently in very bad shape, and he knocked on the door and said, you know, I want to get treated here. And we said, well, we're sorry, this is no longer a clinic, it's been converted into a house. And so he made his way back up the road, and as he was passing in front of one of our big shortwave transmitter antennas, one of these talking arcs established itself. And it just so happened, of course, all of the programming there was Christian programming, and there was some preacher on there that was saying something about God sees you, or, you know, something about along that line. And so this guy was walking along, and suddenly this big, huge loudspeaker came blaring out, a big ball of fire. I think it was after dark, so made it even more impressive. And this big, the voice booming in about God watching him or something. And Ted, that guy was instantly healed. He made it up the road without any trouble at all. Go ahead.
I can only imagine something like that, because I hearing that thing arcing, and of course I've heard this now a couple of times. It can be pretty loud, and it sounds if you don't know it's an arc, and you hear the voice, and it's echoing from all over the place. It's a little spooky. I mean, if you didn't know what it was, I think I'd be hoofing it up a hill too. I'd be on my way. You know, I wouldn't be waiting around to try to analyze the problem or find out what it was.
Right.
So let me ask you this question: when you left out from HCJB, I want to move on a little bit because your background is so extensive. I know you worked several other places. One of the places I know that you and Ruth was Transworld Radio. But I don't know where. Were you ever at the Bonaire location? Tell me a little bit about your stay with Transworld Radio.
Yes, we left Ecuador mainly because of the altitude. We were living in Quito at that time, which is 1,000 feet even higher than at the transmitter site. I was the director of engineering there, and so we still went out to the transmitter site quite a bit and so forth. But anyway, the altitude finally got to us. We had both had hepatitis and were weakened by that, and finally we were advised by the medical people there that we needed to get out of the altitude. So We went to Bonaire with Transworld Radio, and we're there with them for, I think, about a year. I don't remember the exact dates, but my main job there was to work on their 250-kilowatt shortwave, which was a Collins transmitter, quite an old transmitter. It used triodes, push-pull triodes in the output, driven by a pair of push-pull triodes. And it had been working for many years, but was having trouble achieving good modulation. So I spent quite a bit of time working on that, but worked with them a little bit also on their medium wave transmitter, which was a 500 kilowatt, and so just some other stuff like that. We enjoyed our time in Bonaire. Lovely folks there, lovely island. My son got real interested in snorkeling and got his snorkeling license. And I've always loved swimming in the beach, and so we had a lovely time on Bonaire and some very interesting work to do there as well.
Well, I can imagine that that would be a great area for snorkeling and for did you find that a location like Bonaire was the location itself was captivating?
Oh, yeah, it was very, very delightful. Of course, quite different from Ecuador, but a small island. And now the other thing that was fascinating about it, of course, my wife being from Holland, Michigan, as you might guess, is a third-generation Dutch immigrant and still understands and speaks some Dutch. And so, of course, Bonaire being a Dutch territory, I'm not sure the exact what they call it, but it's, very associated with the Dutch government and people. In fact, the Queen of the Netherlands visited while we were there. So they speak Dutch, they speak Spanish, they speak English, and they speak another language, which, as I recall, is called Papamiento or something like that, which is kind of a mixture of Spanish and other stuff. So between Ruth and myself, we had the language situation pretty well covered. And we just had a lovely time. It's a delightful place.
Now, Trans World Radio also had a location that it seems like I remember them, and receiving it, I think, was in Monte Carlo. Does that sound right?
They have an office in Monte Carlo. They do broadcast from Monte Carlo. Yes, we were in Monte Carlo for several weeks. Didn't spend much time at the transmitting station. We were involved with them in Monte Carlo about a monitoring project. They were very advanced in monitoring the reception of their programs, and they put receivers all over the target area, mainly Europe, and they would receive in real time every program that they broadcast, and that data would be transmitted back, and they would analyze it to make sure the programs were going through. That was probably 20 years ago when internet and all those sort of things were much more limited, so they were very pioneering in that. Now the BBC's got a monitoring system that does a similar thing for broadcasters all over the world. But that's why we were there. We probably visited their transmitting site in Monte Carlo, but we didn't work with the transmitters. We were involved with this other monitoring thing.
How big a transmitters were they running in Monte Carlo? I just remember hearing that, and then it seems like the Monte Carlo station, did it not have some kind of history behind it or something? And that just is in my head, but I can't sort it out. I can't find it.
Yeah, I'm a little bit rusty on that too, but as I recall the way that worked out, during the war, Hitler built a big facility there for broadcasting. And I don't think it ever went on the air. I think the building was built. Maybe the transmitters were not fully equipped or something, because later on, some of the equipment that had been at that site actually went to HCJB. So we had some equipment at HCJB with German markings on it, which apparently were a part of that installation. But after the war, quite a while after the war, I think that building came into the hands of Transworld Radio, and that's the site that they used then, and put in more modern equipment and so forth for broadcasting all over Europe. Before that, they had been in Tangier, Morocco, and they had to leave there because of political changes and so forth. And that's when that Monte Carlo opportunity opened up. So they had the transmitting site there, but they also had some major offices there, and that's where we were working.
And I guess at that time was the fellow in charge, this Dr. Paul Fried, or was was that someone else that was kind of like
the... Yeah, he certainly was the one that got the thing going in Monte Carlo. I mean, in Morocco, Voice of Tangier, and he was still around when we were there. He may have been retired, and his son had taken over. But he was certainly a very key figure in all of that.
I guess the next question I would ask is that the Trans World Radio HCJB, but you've done more so. Tell us a little bit about other projects that you've been involved in as far as shortwave radio is concerned and a little bit about the technical side of what you've been involved in.
Well, we have been involved with FEBA, FEBA, Far East Broadcasting Associates, in the Seychelles, which are islands just off the coast of Africa, close to Madagascar. We went there to install a Harris transmitter. We installed that transmitter and also upgraded another Harris transmitter that they had there to use the 100 kilowatt tubes instead of the 50 kilowatts, which that SW100 originally used. So we were there for about a year. In fact, we were there twice. But we were mainly involved there with upgrading their equipment. And boy, talk about another paradise. Missionaries are supposed to go to bad places. Places where things are really rough and tough and all that, but we lucked out. We spent some time in Quito, Ecuador, very delightful place, Bonaire, and then the Seychelles. So we got some assignments to some very nice places.
Well, when you're in an area like the Seychelles, what is it like, for example, if you, of course, I don't know what the population is there, but I mean, I guess you can't do something like on a Saturday night. You can't order a pizza and have it delivered, I would think. And what's it like as far as getting medical attention and things like that?
We did have a little bit of medical need. The mission that we were, that FEBA itself operated a hospital, actually a mission hospital. So Ruth needed some attention while we were there, and we were able to get that from one of the missionary doctors. As far as pizzas, yeah, because that's a tourist place. A lot of European tourists go to the Seychelles. So a lot of lovely beaches and very nice, resort hotels. Probably at least a dozen resort hotels, 4 and 5 star hotels. We used to go buy one of those every now and then and eat a breakfast brunch. There was at least one pizza joint, as I can recall, and we frequented that quite a bit. The shopping for groceries was a little bit challenging. There wasn't anything like what we would, you know, the neighborhood Kroger store. We would have to go to these small shops, and it was the kind of deal where you go in there and you tell the guy what you want, and he's behind the counter and he gets it off the shelf and packages it up for you. So it was kind of like. Being in a time warp back into the way it was here in this country, maybe in 1930, but it was certainly not primitive, and it was quite an adventure, actually. Lovely folks in the Seychelles, and most of them spoke English. I think French is their main language, but we didn't have any trouble communicating. But we had a nice time there, and certainly if you like the beach, and again, snorkeling, a great snorkeling place, so our son just ate it up.
Well, okay, now, you know, you're on an island like that, and you're working on a transmitter. I guess my question is what's it like in terms of when things go down, when you are needing, parts and things like that? You know, being in a place like the Seychelles, or even as far as that goes, Bonaire, and possibly, well, I don't know, because HCJ did so much of the building themselves. Do you have things at your disposal, like a machine shop, or do you, and if you did, I don't, of course, I would be useless with a machine shop. I wouldn't know what to do. But how do you get your hands on something when the transmitter's down? And the other question is, do you just get used to having to wait for the part to get there?
Well, I'm not inclined that way, to wait for things. We had several advantages. Most of the places that we worked did have good machine shops and local fellows that were very skilled, and welders and lathe operators and people that knew how to do all that kind of stuff, sheet metal work. So there were a lot of skilled labor and facilities there, and that helped a lot. But the other thing is that you learn is you never throw anything away. At HCJB, of course, they had been at that transmitting site since 1952, and HCJB had been in Ecuador since 1931, I think. So we kept everything, and there were huge warehouses there full of all sorts of stuff from back in the 30s and the 40s, and there are very few things except in the most modern transmitters that you can't scrounge around some way and make a substitute. Now, one problem we got into, and this first appeared when we brought in our 500 kilowatt transmitter, the technology in that transmitter was, about a 20 or 30 year jump into the future compared with the other stuff we had. So suddenly we had a transmitter that had literally hundreds of parts that you could, like chips, computer chips and things like that. There's just no substitute for having the right one. So that did hinder our ability to make do, shall we say. But the way we handled that usually was by trying to keep, a lot of spare parts on hand. And if worse came to worst, someone could fly down and hand carry something to you, go into a place in Miami and pick up at that time HCJB's home base was Miami, and someone could go into a Radio Shack and buy a chip or get one quickly and then just take a plane down the next day. If you're off the air with a big radio station like that, the cost of lost air is so high that you can afford to do heroic measures to get the parts you need. But my forte and what I really enjoyed was figuring out ways to work around the lack of a component and make something work by being a little bit inventive.
Have you ever done things like build capacitors or winding your own inductors and that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. Well, most of our inductors were homemade. Of course, the type of inductors that we used were large, typical 1-inch copper tubing and sometimes bigger than that. So, copper tubing is available everywhere because people use it for plumbing. And capacitors, if you keep some Teflon around and things like that, a lot of times you can do those. For resistors, you can use water heater elements and all kinds of things. So it was always fun to try to come up with a solution.
I can imagine. Well, in all that time, in all of that... all your travels and the things you did, I guess I want to say how much of your time was used, though, because of the nature of the power levels you're working with shortwave, how much of your time is used repairing or, I guess I want to say, troubleshooting or keeping a transmitter actually on the air? And how much of your time would you say you could do preventive maintenance because they were running smoothly?
Fixing or maintaining a big high-powered radio station like that is, as they say, kind of like flying an airplane. It's hours of boredom punctuated by moments of sheer panic. And because when things went off the air, we did everything possible to get back on the air very, very quickly. Not only because some of the programs were paid programs and we lost the income, but mainly because we felt the message was very important and it needed to go out. But yeah, it would be there would be times when things would be running smoothly, and then we would try to do maintenance and anticipate problems. But when things went off, it was all hands on deck. We always had at least one man on call right on the site, either in his office working or in a home within 3 or 4 minutes of the site. And we had Ecuadorians that were operating the transmitters. We never ran unattended. And when a transmitter went off, boy, the call went out, and there was one or more engineers there on site immediately to troubleshoot. Now, one thing about big transmitters like that is the troubleshooting part is usually not too difficult. When you've got 100 or 500 kilowatts floating around in a circuit, if there's a problem, if there's a fault, It usually makes itself very manifest. You open the door and a part is either charred, black, or missing, and so you know what the problem is.
Well, I guess I only reason I ask that is it seems to me that in the high power transmitter arena with shortwave, it's a vigil. In other words, you're always active doing something. And a lot of shortwave stations today are run with remote control. The transmitter's in the building. No one's home. And that makes for a whole different type of parameter than it does when you actually have engineers on duty watching the transmitters.
Well, that's true. And, of course, automation has made huge steps. You know, back in most of the times that we were working, the idea of even remotely turning on and off a transmitter or remotely reading meters was not an option. So, plus the fact that most of the equipment we worked with was in countries where there were people who needed work, that were willing to work and happy to work for what to us seemed like a very minimal wage. And so the stations that we were with were always looking for opportunities to give people employment. And so many times it was actually not only cheaper but more humane and in keeping with our mission to have actual hands and eyes watching the transmitter rather than do everything remotely. But that gradually changed, and as technology became more available, the idea of remote control and all that became more feasible. But for most of our career, it was all done by humans. I don't think that we ever worked at a station that was not a manned station. The one in Australia that we work with some now, HCJB in Australia, now called Reach Beyond Australia, that's a remote automated site, but we haven't spent very much time there, and most every place we've been has had personnel on duty.
Well, let's go back a little ways. Let's go back to John Stanley as a kid, okay? And why don't you talk a little bit about how you first got introduced to amateur radio and radio in general, or did you have interest in shortwave as a child?
Yeah, that was probably mainly due to the influence of a friend of my father's who really was such a close friend. We called him Uncle Harvey. He was like a brother to my father. They'd been to dental school together, and our family always did a lot of stuff together. And every year we would go to Jacksonville Beach, Florida, for a week, and Harvey would come along with his family. And Harvey was a ham operator, and I don't remember, I've long since forgotten his call. It would have been a W-4 call. But one year when we were down there at the beach, he raised the question between myself and my three brothers, would you guys like to be, to learn about ham radio? And he sort of didn't give us the opportunity to say no. He just started, he got out his oscillator and started teaching us Morse code. And we were, I guess I was probably more interested in it than my siblings, but he worked hard with us, and he got me to where I could copy enough code that, I finally went and took my novice license. And I would have been about 14. I got my license when I was 14, so it was probably about 13 when he started working with us. And in the meantime, I had enjoyed taking things apart. I could think of some. In fact, I shudder to think now of a couple of the old Atwater Kent and older radios that I got given to us, and I just took them apart because I thought it was fun to look at all the components, and probably some of those radios would be worth a lot more now as a radio than they than they were after I destroyed them. But that's what got me going. And so Uncle Harvey was the one that did that. He later dropped out of ham radio. He wasn't able to make the transition from AM to sideband. And when sideband became the dominant mode of phone, he just kind of got disgusted and left the hobby. But in those early days, he was a very big influence on me.
So what was your first amateur radio rig, and what was that all about?
Well, I got a let's see. The first thing I did was I bought a National NC 50, I think it was. No, that doesn't ring a bell. Anyway, it was the little 5-tube National receiver. It cost about $50 at the time, which would be more like, you know, equivalent of about $1,000 today. And I did a lot of listening, listened to HCJB, listened to hams, listened to CW, got my code speed up a little bit, went and got my novice, and I finally bought a transmitter then that used a single 6L6, had a built-in power supply, so it had a 5U4 probably and a 6L6 on the same chassis, and crystal controlled, of course, put out maybe 10 watts. And with that, I began what turned out to be a very undistinguished novice career. I don't think in the year I was a novice, I made more than probably 30 or 40 contacts. So I was not what you would call burning up the ham bands with my novice activity.
Why was that, though? I would have thought you'd have been totally immersed in it.
Well, I've learned a few things since then. I don't think I had a very good signal. I was using a long wire antenna, probably coupled to maybe a watt or two into it. And nowadays people do a lot with QRP, but back then the receivers weren't that good either. That 5-tube receiver that I had was not very stable. And of course, you know, back in those days, the way the novice band worked, you had a 50 kilohertz slice of frequency, and you'd call on your crystal frequency, and then you'd tune the whole band. You'd tune 50 kilohertz, the whole band, looking for somebody calling you. And by the time you found them, they might have quit transmitting. So it was difficult. Not to say that there weren't people that were very successful, but they learned operating skills that I didn't have. I, by the way, relived my novice days later on, maybe 10 years later than that, or 15. I got an ARC 5 receiver that would tune the novice band, and I set up another little crystal control receiver or transmitter. And what I did is I set my receiver to the crystal frequency, and I just sat there and waited. And when I heard someone, I'd gone about and do my other activities, and when I heard someone calling CQ within a kilohertz or three of my frequency, then I would call them back. And during that 6 months that I was playing with that, I probably worked 10 times more stations on the novice band. By then, I was a general class operator, but I just did it for the fun of it. But I finally had a good novice career, but it was not when I was a novice.
Well, I recall, like, for example, the 75-meter novice band being 3,700 to 3,750, which is that 50 kilohertz you're talking about. And your rockbound, 75 watts input to the final. Of course, most novices couldn't get up to 75 watts because they were running little single tube, 6V6, 6L6. I mean, I saw a couple of novice transmitters that were running, like, 6BQ5s, you know, in the finals. So they were pretty limited power-wise. But that whole process of calling on one frequency and tuning up and down and up and down the band until you found somebody answering you, that was, I guess I want to say, that was kind of an art in itself, wouldn't you think? I mean, did people develop a technique for doing that? And then even crossband, I remember... a guy calling, or there was a fella on I believe it was on the 40-meter novice band, and he was calling, and if you listen closely, he was telling you that he was receiving on somewhere on the 75-meter band. So I'd seen guys actually do that before, you know. So and that would take more technique than the average novice would have, I would think. I don't know, but but tuning up and down the band looking for that one person. Or, you know, the most frustrating thing would be the guy calling CQ, and you try to answer him on your crystal frequency. And the anticipation of, is he going to hear me? Is he going to hear me? You know. So it was different, but that was challenging, but that was really fun, I thought.
Yeah, it had a certain charm about it. And, of course, being all new and everything, you know, that was exciting. I later got my, before my novice expired, I got my technician license because I didn't want to lose my call sign. And at that time, technicians could only operate above 220 megahertz. But so I fooled around on 440 with a buddy of mine a little bit, and we never got more than a half a mile using modulated oscillators, 6J6s and stuff. And then later on, they opened up 6 meters to the technicians, and I got on 6 meters. Well, at that time, we did the same thing on 6 meters. You would have a crystal that would be, let's say, 50.1 or 50.4 or 50.45. I forget. They were all military crystals that you would multiply up into the 6 meter band. So you'd call on 50.1, and then you'd tune from 50 to 51 megahertz, a whole megahertz of frequency, but it would be AM, so you could tune a little faster than with CW. And some guy on 50.4 might answer you. So you know, you'd be on 50.1, he'd be on 50.4. But it was similar to what we did on the novice band. But back in those days on AM on 6 meters, we hit a ball.
Well, I'm just curious now. In the peak of your amateur radio activities, would you say that you operate more today, or you operated more in the past? What's how does ham radio fare up today?
I would say the most operating that I did was probably, I did a lot during the AM days once I finally got my general class and got on phone. I did quite a bit, but probably the most operating in just in terms of time on the air was when I was in Ecuador. And I used to operate several hours a day or night. I was on 75 meters working back into the States from Ecuador, which was, I usually operated on bands that nobody else did. And there was a reason for that. On 20 meters, okay, you're on 14 megs and sitting 200 yards from your house, there's a shortwave transmitter operating 100 kilowatts on 15 megs. Well, that takes a doggone good receiver to cut that, you know, to everything got overloaded. So my strategy was I would go as far away from those shortwave broadcasts as I could, and I started out on 75 meters. At that time, we were not broadcasting below 6 meters on any frequency, and those transmitters happened to be, or their antennas were a little bit further from my house. So I became a big 75-meter operator from Ecuador, and built a kilowatt rig, and I built a array of six verticals, which had a pretty good beam, a pretty good power to the States. And I operated a lot of 75 meters into the States from Ecuador and had a blast. And I was usually on there several hours a day. So probably the peak in terms of sheer hours of time would have been during the 13 years that we were in Ecuador.
Well, what did you find to be, and I guess I'll say even right now today, the most enjoyable thing, the thing that really, I guess I want to say, flips your switches as far as amateur radio is concerned today? With all the experience you've had with these huge transmitters and building antenna systems, you know, you and I could talk for hours with me picking your brain, and we could probably fill up 52 QSO shows. But what do you, what I guess I want to say, what's been the most enjoyable thing?
That's varied, I think, from time to time. When we were in India, I operated a lot of 20 meters, by the way, and I should have mentioned that. I used to work 20-meter long path back into the States from India, and I did that on a daily basis. And that combined two aspects of ham radio that I enjoy. One of them is talking to people that are far away, but mainly talking to people that you know. It doesn't particularly ring my bells to get on and exchange signal reports with a whole bunch of people in Russia or Greece or, you know, wherever it might be that there are people that I don't know, and maybe their language skills in English are not perfect, and my Russian and Greek are certainly not perfect. So, you know, it's kind of a 5-9 thing and bye-bye. I enjoyed very much operating from India. And to the same extent in Ecuador, talking back into the States, not trying to work DX for the sake of DX, but working DX because I was DX, working a long distance to get back to people that I knew and had contacts with. There was one guy, W4UWC in Knoxville, he's now W4UW, George Dominic. He and I used to talk when I was in India. We would talk almost daily on the long path from India back to Knoxville. And because he was in the area, you know, where that I was from, he'd fill me in on all the local news. And even occasionally he would mention something about my family. We couldn't run phone patches. That wasn't allowed. But he could, you know, say, I saw your sister, you know, at church the other day, and she said such and such and things like that. So I really enjoyed that a lot. And then later on, I used to work George from Ecuador, and I've worked him from the Seychelles, I believe. In fact, at one time, I joked with George about the fact that, hey, George, someday you might get a DXCC, work 100 different countries, and they'll all be with me. Because we had worked him from Bon Air and, I don't know, a bunch of places. So I guess those were the days that I really enjoyed talking to people that I know, and the fact that they were halfway around the world made it somewhat more exciting. Most of my operating now is still with people I know, but, you know, they're maybe 100 miles away. And I could do it on Skype. I could do it, you know, on a cell phone. But I do it on ham radio because I just enjoy the technology. But that was fun stuff back in those days.
I agree with you. I think that that there is something different. You could call you know, somebody on a cell phone, but it's not the same. In other words, you're sitting there and you're putting an energy into an antenna. You're bouncing a signal off the ionosphere, and in the process of that, there's other people that can join in, that can jump right in the middle of the conversation and say, hey. Or they can sit back and eavesdrop on your talking, you know, which you can't really do that on a cell phone. And then, you know, all of a sudden you can't take your cell phone and start tuning around and find a couple of guys talking about something that interests you. And then all of a sudden you can break in and become part of the conversation and they'd be 200-300 miles away. You can't do that on a cell phone. So I don't know. I think that there's a myriad of reasons as to why ham radio is fascinating and compelling, and why the hobby itself is conducive to learning and advancing and all those things. And you just, that doesn't happen on Skype or on a cell phone. I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
No, it absolutely does. And that the technical part of it is certainly very fascinating. I've always been interested in propagation studies, and even though I've operated transmitters that have 500 kilowatts of raw power, and if you convert that to ERP and you know, based on the antenna gain and change it to PEP based on you know, peak modulation, we're talking 100 megawatts. And so I've operated some pretty powerful stations. But I'm more fascinated when I come on, as I've done from Ecuador on 10 meters. I made a contact back into the States with 50 milliwatts. Here in the States, I've made some contacts on 40 and 60 meters with 10 milliwatts. So to me, it just illustrates the fact that when the propagation is in your favor, you can do things that are unbelievable in terms of what people normally think of as the power that's required to do certain things. So I do enjoy QRP operation. I've operated quite a bit of QRP on PSK. But the reason that's fascinating to me is because it just illustrates that by trying to understand how the signals get from one place to another, it enables you to do some things that are very remarkable and just lots of fun.
Well, you know, I guess I want to say I was doing some, I was just messing around with an antenna that we had put up in the backyard, and I think I was on 17 meters, and I was making contacts on 17 and on 20 and on 15, and I was talking all over Europe and everything, and I was commenting on the fact, I thought, you know, this is pretty remarkable. I'm doing this with a barefoot 100-watt radio. It was a Linko DX70, you know, into this antenna. And we just kept working until finally I was a little bit tired and I stopped. And then I happened to glance down at the radio. I looked and it said it was in the low power position. So all that while we'd only been running 10 watts, okay? And it worked all these places and got great signal reports on top of it, you know? So I don't know. I think when propagation is right and you've got a good antenna system, power becomes far less important, I think. I think there's too much emphasis placed on power sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. And, You know, to me, the fact that you're making it hard, hams love to do things that are hard to do. That's one of the reasons why we're always doing this crazy stuff on bands that don't normally, you know, it's so easy to work 100 countries on 20 meters. Why would you not do that instead of trying to work 100 countries on 6 meters or God forbid 2 meters? But you know, that's what people do. They try to work a lot of places on bands that don't get through, or even 160 meters. I mean, we know we can do it on 20 meters, but it's harder to do it on the other bands. So that's why we do it. We do it because it's a challenge. And so to me, that's the same thing with QRP. Yeah, you can work this the expedition great, you know, with a monster beam and a kilowatt, but to work them with 100 watts to a dipole, that's a little bit more of a challenge. So there's that aspect of it, I think.
And that was, I was just going to say, though, that was such a surprise to see that we had worked all these countries, got these great reports, and we're doing it on 10 watts and didn't even know it. And I was already making concessions saying, this is amazing that we're doing this only with 100 watts, you know. Little did I know. You know? So, now let me say this, and we're kind of getting to the close to the end here, so keep in mind anything that you may want to add to this broadcast. What differences would people notice, let's say if you're out in the field and you're listening, you know, between a shortwave, a high-power shortwave station running 50,000 or then possibly at the level of 100,000 and then maybe going up to 250. Is there really that much difference in the field if you're on the right band and the propagation is decent?
Yeah, that's something we give a lot of thought to in shortwave broadcasting, because, you know, you don't want to be wasting power, and there are times when you could be overpowered on a transmission. A good rule of thumb, I think, is if you double the power, it's just noticeable in most cases. But there are a lot of cases where if you double the power, it's not noticeable at all. For example, you know, receivers have a thing called an automatic gain control. And if you're already into the point where the signal is full quieting, shall we say, you could multiply the power by 10 and it won't sound any different. And there are other times when a slight increase, particularly if you've got interference, and then just a little bit more makes you a little bit stronger than the other guy, it might make a fairly significant difference. But that's something that we work with a lot. And in planning shortwave broadcasts, we convert those things all back to what's called reliability. People who work with VOA cap and other propagation programs, and a lot of hams do that, will be aware of the reliability as one of the output parameters of that program. So knowing when a little bit of extra power will add to your reliability or ability to get through or to make the contact, as we hams would say, and when it doesn't, that's a complicated issue, and it depends on many, many different factors. But most of the time, I think people overestimate the advantage of additional power. You know, a lot of people, it sounds pretty exciting to them if they could double their power, but in actual fact, the day-to-day operations would probably show that probably no one would notice.
Well, that's interesting, and I've wondered about that. I know that on FM broadcast, it's the antenna and the height, and the power is almost irrelevant. The power level is nowhere near as critical as the antenna and the actual antenna height above ground. And that seems to be the main thing. With shortwave, though, you're dealing with angles of radiation. You're dealing with the height of the antenna affecting how many different factors, do you think?
Oh, yeah, there's so many of those things come into play. My personal feeling is that the main reason that the main thing that a lot of hams could do that would really affect their ability to communicate would be to make sure that their antenna is receiving the power. And you know, hams can be overly obsessed with SWR. There's no question about that. But besides just the SWR, sometimes people say, well, if I add a tuner, it will improve the SWR. It might actually hurt your signal because the losses in the tuner might more than compensate. Once you get below about 2 to 1, You know, that's the point of diminishing returns in terms of SWR. But on the other hand, there are people who will run a dipole using it on a band it's not cut for and have 10 dB of loss in their antenna, in their feed line, and even though they're matching it perfectly with a tuner, they're still losing that 10 dB. So getting your antenna to be efficient, not just matched, not just tuned as to, you know, good as to SWR, but properly matched, maybe go to open line or something like that, or just use a dipole that's cut closer to the frequency. Those are things that I think help people a lot more than just raising power. And certainly they're a lot cheaper to do, almost in every case. So you should do those things first. Do the easy things first, and then if you still can't get through, then do the more difficult things.
Well, see, you should design and build an antenna efficiency meter. I don't know where you would connect it in the line, but nonetheless, you know, yeah.
I don't know about a meter, but you know, if you read some of the stuff in the handbook or in the antenna book, or even that appears in QSD from time to time about losses in feed lines, it can be very eye-opening. Antennas make a huge... Of course, the other thing great about antennas is that they help you both coming and going. They help on receive and transmit. One of the things I've enjoyed doing in a few places we've been at is using broadcast antennas for ham operations. And one of the places we did that was in Chile. When we were down there setting up a new station, eight transmitters, 100 kilowatts each, it took about a year to get all that equipment on the air. And so in the meantime, I was able to use the broadcast antennas for ham operation. And I was using an antenna that had 17 dB of gain, and it was beamed to the States. Well, in fact, I had two of them, one beamed the East Coast, one West, and I could switch between them. And on 40 meters, that just did amazing things. And I had an experience like you were talking about. I worked a whole big string of mobiles and everybody else and then noticed that, hey, I'm only running 10 watts. Same radio that you talked about, by the way, the DX70. So, a good antenna is helps you not only to hear them but to work them.
Well, you know what? We're out of time. I've really enjoyed this. Any final thoughts, things that you'd like to share before we have to... you know, get on down the road here?
Well, I would just say this. Ruth and I have had a great life. We've been to a lot of places and done a lot of things, and we feel like what we've done is important. We feel like a lot of people have heard the gospel message that would not have heard it had we not been allowed to be involved in setting up some of these radio stations and doing some of these things. It's been exciting, and it's been fun. It's been rewarding. Ham radio has been a very important part of it, and we both feel that you know, God prepared us for the job He wanted us to do, and a very big part of that preparation was ham radio, and so we're very grateful for that.
Well, thank you much. You're going to have to come back. That's just all there is to it. We'll have to have an antenna show, and we'll have to have one on. Specifically on how to receive DRM on your ham equipment or your general coverage receiver or whatever you have, and we'll have to do another one when Ruth is around, when she can get on and talk with us as well. So I'm telling you folks, these people are amazing. You could spend, regardless of how much time you spend with them. When they have to leave, it seems like the time has just been way too short. And John has helped us at WTWW, John and Ruth both, and their help has been invaluable. No, I don't know of anyone else on the planet that knows and can do what they know and can do what they can do. So 73 to you, John. Thank you so much for joining us here on QSO, and look forward to having you back again real soon.
Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, Be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Well, you know what? We flat ran out of time. That's it for QSO today. Hey, I want to remind you to listen to QSO Saturday afternoons, 1 o'clock on 9475. That's 1 p.m. Central Time on 9475. Also, at 7 p.m. On Sundays, 7 p.m. on Sundays, that's on 5085. Also, Amateur Radio Roundtable is heard Tuesday nights on 5085. That's Amateur Radio Roundtable, and that's on Tuesday nights, 8 p.m. Central Time on 5085. And also on W5KUB.com. You can go up there and check that out, W5KUB.com. Well, until next week, same time, same station, from QSO to you, 73s.